$16.50.
If I had known that, we might sing the whole song. I don't know if we're quite up to your spirit. Yesterday about the letter to the Romans, and I made a big deal out of it. I like the study of Romans and all of its various intricacies there. But there is one thing I shortchanged you all on yesterday when talking about the letter to the Romans, and that concerns the theme of the book. And I should have, I thought about this slide yesterday and said, boy, I should have a slide on this, but I don't. And that's probably good anyway. It's good to turn the pages of your Bibles and look things actually up. And so I'm going to give you what I think is a fuller definition of the theme of the book. If you had opened to Romans, the third chapter, and we'll read verse 24. And I'm going to cut and paste here a couple of passages here in the third of Romans. In verse 24 we read, being justified freely by his grace. And then I jump to verse 28. By his grace through faith, justified by faith. Years ago, that's where I would have stopped, and I think that's where I stopped yesterday, when saying that was the theme of Romans, that an individual is justified by grace through faith. Bingo. Period, full stop. That did you a disservice, and it does any student of Paul's letter a disservice right there. Now so flip over to the 12th chapter. Remember what I just said, because in thinking about what the theme of the book is, I would add to what I just said, these days. And it comes from the verse again that we looked at yesterday, a very familiar verse, Romans 12:1. Now I'll put it this way. You can look at Romans 12:1, very familiar. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present yourselves, present your bodies a living sacrifice, and so forth. Offering to you the theme of this book now, I would say that it is that one is justified by the grace of God through faith. Therefore, present your bodies a living sacrifice unto the Lord, and so forth. To stop, as I have done for many years, saying that one is justified by grace through faith, and that's it, does a disservice to the audience and a disservice to the apostle. It ignores fully one-fourth of the book there. That therefore is very important there in understanding what the theme of the book is. I'll paraphrase, I'll tell you what I mean there. And therefore is a conjunction. He's saying that as a result of what I have told you, do this. This is the result of what I have told you. It's important, the sequence. Not just in this particular little phrase, but in how the entire letter is outlined. is justified by faith, therefore present yourselves a living sacrifice. We do not try to present ourselves as a sacrifice in order to be justified. This is critical in looking at the letter to the Romans here. We could amplify it by looking back at the third chapter, and Paul will say that you're justified by faith without works of the law. My particular opinion is that that phrase, works of the law, there probably means just about anything. They're not just the formal sacrifices under the law. One is justified, and therefore one does what he says in chapters 12 through the end of the book. It is not the other way around. You do not do it in order to be justified. Okay. You can conjure on that, but I think that that's the message that he's getting out. Romans is like we said yesterday, is different from all his other letters. This is how he's setting forth the gospel message as he understands it, in the manner in which he thinks it ought to be put forward, and what ought to be emphasized. It is sequential in its organization. The justification, therefore. We do not have anywhere near enough time to explore this letter in any kind of absolute detail and look at all of the, go down all of the avenues that it presents for us. But we are going to look at a couple of them today. And as we have talked in this class, I'm going to suggest to you that among all of the things that Paul has in his mind to construct his position of the gospel according to Jesus Christ is the matter of Uriah the Hittite. And so let's take a look at some of the things that I'm going to suggest reflect that idea. Now, we'll start off, I call them echoes of the matter of Uriah the Hittite. And then what I mean by that is that these aren't passages where Paul will say or reference something that is, you can tie directly back to the matter. And so I certainly wouldn't be dogmatic on this. The first one is this one up here. We talked about it yesterday, and that comes from the salutation of the letter, where he says, Jesus Christ, our Lord, which was made of the seed of David according to the flesh. That's an interesting way to put it. He may mean there that Jesus of Nazareth was a descendant in the royal line.
And that's certainly possible, but I would suggest to you that that may not be, and I don't think it is what he means there. And I would ask you to look at Romans, the fourth chapter. You can just and look at the first verse or so of the fourth chapter. And he uses the same language to, when he's talking about Abraham. He says, what shall we say then concerning Abraham? And let me get it right. Our father, as pertaining to the flesh, hath found. And what he means here in this particular passage about Abraham is that Abraham's justification, if you will, had nothing to do with anything that Abraham did in his flesh. This is his argument that will come in the next couple of verses. He will say that Abraham believed God, quoting from Genesis, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, for that was the mechanism of his justification. Alright. We won't digress into that, but I think that that's what he probably means here when he's talking about David according to the flesh. He's talking about the action, what happened in David's life, what kind of man he was, and that sort of thing. Among which, of course, is this matter of Uriah the Hittite. In Romans, this is another echo here, the second chapter of Romans, and this is indicative of the way he writes and why I say the letter is particularly impersonal, but I am struck by his terminology. You are inexcusable, O man. And that makes me think of what Nathan said to David. You are the man. Thus saith the Lord. All right. That's in Romans 2:4, he uses the term, do you despise the riches of his goodness and forbearance? The key thing is that term despising right there. That's exactly what Nathan said to David. Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord? You get the flavor of what I'm driving at here, whether you're convinced or not, that's okay. That in the terminology that Paul uses here is reflective of the matter of Uriah the Hittite. Speaking universally to all of us, to the Romans, do we despise the riches of God as Nathan accuses David? And we've talked about this somewhat before. Again, the terminology. But if you bear the name Jew and rely upon the law, he doesn't stop there. He says, and you boast in God, know his will. And I ask you to think about that 2 Samuel 22 passage. What is Paul thinking of when he uses that term, you boast in God? 2 Samuel 21 through 25 is certainly, if not boasting, a an expression of feeling that, you know, I've done right.
Here. Continuing in the second chapter, if you are confident, you are a light to those that are in darkness.
We talked about this when we discussed the matter. The name Uriah means the light of God. You're confident that you are a light. Yahweh is my light. There.
In Romans 1:31, he talks about mankind,
the deficiencies that mankind shows in his actions in it. Interesting term he uses there to indict the human race is covenant breakers. To a Roman audience, that's going to be a puzzling, to say the least, phrase to use to them. They're not used to understanding this idea of covenants. And it could mean a lot of things, but the term Bathsheba, who was the wife of Uriah, the term Bathsheba translates as daughter of an oath, daughter of a covenant. And that's another allegorical way possible of looking at the matter there. If you think about her name, you will see that the matter involves the breaking of a covenant there between Bathsheba and Uriah, as well as other ways as well. These are interesting passages here. You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that one should not steal, do you steal? If that doesn't remind you of what Nathan said to David, then you won't get the image of the lamb there on the right. Remember the parable that he offered to David. There was a rich man and a poor man, and so forth. Poor man just had one ewe lamb. But the rich man, in order to provide a feast, did not want to take of his own flocks. He stole the lamb out of the poor man's flock. And it's coupled with the idea, you who say that one should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? Reminds me of what Nathan said to David, how he indicted him for his behavior. The name of God, this is in Romans 2:24, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Again, the terminology is very similar to the terminology that Nathan used when talking to David. It isn't just a matter, wasn't just a matter of adultery and theft and ultimately murder. You have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. There's what you have done. You have degraded me in the eyes of everybody around this nation. This one is probably hard to see for the folks in the back because we put in a long passage in Romans, the second chapter. But this is the passage where Paul is arguing that circumcision is only of value if it is undergirded by the actions which it symbolizes. Circumcision is of value if you practice the law, but if you are a transgressor of the law, it's meaningless. And he goes in these verses by talking about circumcision. And that God would pay more attention in a lot of circumstances, to an uncircumcised individual than he would one that was circumcised. So we think and we ask this question about Uriah. Uriah was of what nationality? Was he a Jew? No, he was a Hittite. My thinking is he's probably uncircumcised. I concede that can be argued. But David was known for surrounding himself with non-Jewish people. Even one of the command, even during the rebellion of Absalom, one of the commanders of, we would call it today, one of the divisions of his army was a non-Jew. And so we at least have a link here of what Paul is maybe driving at. Again, he uses the boasting business in 3:27, whereas boasting then in 2 Samuel 22, for all his judgments were before me, and as for his statutes, I did not depart from them. That is probably true, but it may be one of the things that we should be cautious about saying. It's interesting in Romans 6 that he describes the sin as being that which provokes lust. And this one I can see. This one's much more of a stretch there. You can have, it's an apt description of sin in any manifestation there, but I find it interesting in, if I think about the matter of Uriah, because this lust is the term that we use that probably undergirded, or that's what we would use to describe David's actions. This one comes from, as you see up there, the 13th of Romans. And it is a recitation by Paul of several of the Ten Commandments. I find it interesting the order in which he places these. Because they're out of order as they are listed in Exodus and Deuteronomy there. The head of the list, or at least this section of the list, is you shouldn't commit adultery. And then you shall not murder or shall not kill. It's a strong term right there that he uses. He doesn't say you shall not kill. He says you shall not commit murder. The order in the Ten Commandments is you shall not kill, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal. He reverses the adultery and the murder business here. And for good measure, he throws in the last one, you shall not covet. If this doesn't describe, in a nutshell, all of the problems in the matter, it's hard to think of anything else that you would add to the list. Now, it's in Romans 13. All the others that I've cited have been in the first part of the book. That section of the book, first I think I went up through the 8th chapter, that section of the book, which I would basically describe as what it means or and how it's accomplished, that one is justified by grace through faith. This particular passage is after the therefore. The therefore. You shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, and so forth. It's something that applies to us in our actions now as justified individuals. Okay. Those are a few of the echoes of the matter of Uriah the Hittite, and you might be saying to yourself, wouldn't be surprised if you are, if our roles were reversed and I was in your place, I'd be saying this. That's very nice, Casey. Very clever to put all of this together. Too clever by half, you see. As you noted up there, there's nothing in anything that you've cited that refers directly to the matter of Uriah the Hittite at all up there. It is true that in a general sense, everything you've cited could be applied to the matter, but that's true of sin in general. So, even echoes may be too strong a term to use. Hey, I've run these ideas by brothers, sisters that I have respected. I say have because one of them, unfortunately, is no longer with us. And the feedback I got was not true. Not quite convinced about it. Okay, that's fine. You can be convinced about the echoes at your leisure. I just present them to you as something to think about. Where do we go from here? Oh, there are more than echoes of the matter of Uriah the Hittite in the letter to the Romans. the progression from Psalm 51 to Romans 3 is not my idea. Martha's idea. Putting it up there because she knew I was going to talk about the 51st chapter, and the more I look at the way that she put it up, the better I like it and I see the meaning behind it. You sung a portion of Psalm 51 this morning, as you did yesterday, and you haven't turned it up yet. Jim up here in the front row is already back to Psalm 51. He's read my mind here, because I was going to ask you, what was the superscription of Psalm 51? This is a psalm that David wrote after Nathan came and pointed the finger at him. This is not an echo of the matter of Uriah the Hittite. This is an actual citation from it, essentially. What is the citation? Feel free to open your Bibles to Psalm 51. See what David says there. Up here we have a breakdown. It's hard to read the verses. We're breaking the psalm down into verses there. Verses 1 through 4 of the psalm are a prayer for forgiveness. 5 through 12, it's a plea for renewal. 13 through 17, a pledge of gratitude. And 18 and 19, a petition for Zion. Psalm 51 is like Romans in one respect. It deserves a much more fuller treatment than I am going to give it right now. A full treatment of this psalm is a week of Bible school classes in and of itself there. But we are going to look at a couple of things and also look at how Paul uses it in his letter to the Romans. Again, we've highlighted the superscription, Psalm of David, when Nathan the prophet came into him after he had gone into Bathsheba. So we know that this is part of the matter. This is, and if you can read that, this is the psalm that he wrote. Have mercy upon me according to thy loving kindness. Made a hymn over that. You all have sung it 2 days in a row. Have mercy upon me. Blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity. We also have a hymn off of that line. We change it a little bit. We say, thoroughly wash me. But this has been fertile ground for those that are talented at writing hymns and composing music to go with them. I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. This is the part that I want to concentrate on right here, because this is the part of the psalm that Paul uses
in Romans. This is the direct quote. I think he's got other things in mind, and it's this first part of it there where David says, against thee, thee only, have I sinned and done this iniquity, this evil in thy sight. I've often found that to be very curious. Against thee, thee only, have I sinned. Hey, what about Uriah? Did you sin against him? I don't think so. You murdered him. If that's not a sin against anybody, I don't know what is. Hey there. So David's statement there is curious to me. He says there's a reason for this, though. We read remember we talked earlier in the week about what inspiration means and when does it occur? You believe, I believe, that this psalm is inspired by God. The language is curious, don't you suppose? Against thee, thee only, have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight. That, can I change that here to, so that you might be justified when you speak and be clear when you judge? Is David saying there that this episode, this matter happened in order to reveal something about God? And that's why he says against thee, thee only. He's changing the focus. No question about that when somebody discusses the matter. Because, like I say, the first thing that I think most people would say when they read the first four words up there, against thee, thee only have I sinned, it's got to run through your mind, what about Uriah? There. So David is saying here, and I'm not saying that he doesn't feel the transgression, but this is the passage here that Paul keys off of in Romans. You don't turn back over to the third of Romans. And I should have put a slide up on this, but I didn't. If you look at Romans 3, this is where he quotes from Psalm 51. He talks about the Jew. This is that in the fourth verse of the chapter, and he talks about he's talked about those things about what's the advantage to the Jew. He recognizes that some did not believe, but that doesn't nullify the faith of God. And the fourth verse is the quotation from the 51st Psalm here. It's an interesting way in which he uses this passage. Here we read King James, God forbid, yea, let God be true, but every man a liar, as it is written, that thou mightest be justified in thy sayings and mightest overcome when thou art judged.
There's an interesting change right here. Did you pick up on it? Change in the Roman passage versus what we've got up here? Paul is quoting from the Septuagint rendering of Psalm 51. In the non-Septuagint, the Hebrew text, we read that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest and be clear when thou judgest. Paul says you might overcome when thou art judged. And that's a Septuagint rendering. It's a pretty accurate translation of the Septuagint. Look at how that's reading right there. And it's interesting because what Paul is saying from this is that in addition to other things that are in the 51st Psalm, he's using this particular passage to establish the sovereignty and the right of God to do what God does. Look over in the 26th verse of Romans 3. And this is what he means in the citation of that passage from Psalm 51:4. He says, to declare, I say, at this time his righteousness, that he might be just. The he there is God. That he might be just and the justifier of him which believeth in Jesus. Now let me... Isn't that a curious thing? By definition, God is just. There's no need to demonstrate God's justice, is there? Last night, Ed gave us a list of attributes of God. He didn't go into this one. God is just, don't you think? He doesn't have to prove it. All right. We'll continue we've only got a minute or so. Let's see. Yeah. And we'll wind up here with it. It is this passage. This has been curious to me. You all think about this. Thou desirest not sacrifice, else would I give it. Thou delightest not in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. The sacrifices and offerings under the law, which Paul makes a case against their necessity in the matter of justification here, the Roman letter also have in his mind, I think, and I think he's right on this, he finally realizes this as one who has probably practiced the law better than anybody else for a good portion of his life, that the offering of sacrifices under the law can have a perverse effect on the offering. Because and this is what happened with the Jewish people. They make the offer, they can make the offer if the offering is improperly perceived, they can make the offer think that I have done something to stand right in the eyes of God. It's a perverse effect of a well-intended setup there. This is certainly not what God intended. When he instituted the law of Moses, but it is an effect that can happen because of what? Our natures here. And so, this is, I think, I don't know why the Septuagint rendered it the way Paul quotes it here, but in a sense, you are judging God there. And so Paul recognizes that the matter of Uriah the Hittite as it unfolded, and particularly as what David says in Psalm 51, argues strongly and teaches strongly against that particular point. So far to say that David finally realizes that God doesn't want this offering for that particular reason. Because you as the offerer, and David as the offerer, thinks that that wipes his way clean. That makes me back with God. When in effect, when in actuality it was designed to teach what David says here in Psalm 51. You don't desire that sacrifice except the broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart. The matter of Uriah the Hittite is important, not just for that reason, but I think at least for that reason. If we can see it. And that's why he says that. And our time is up for today. We are going to stop. Now, earlier today, before the class, Dan Stanton came up to me and just begged me to assign you all homework tonight. And so I shall. Cover your ears, Dan. He didn't do that. I hope you all know that I'm pulling the flag right now. But I am going to say, suggest to do a little homework here. Because this is not the only place in Romans that is more than an echo of the matter of Uriah the Hittite. So if you'd like to explore what it might be, you can look at the 32nd Psalm. We'll look at that Psalm tomorrow and see what we can derive from that. So thank you for your attention this morning.